Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and football finance expert at Liverpool University, Kieran Maguire, or as he was on various media outlets on Monday, Kevin Maguire, Rob Price, and HRH, the Duchess of Kent. I mean, you haven't got a difficult name, Kieran, but three or four people managed to get it wrong, didn't they?
That's right. I was making my debut on BBC 6 o'clock news as well, and they got it right. And I was just about to... I've always had a bit of a thing for Fiona Bruce as well. So for me, it was a dream come true. She's top of my A-list. For them to get my name wrong was heartbreaking.
Does that mean you want to hear about the hour I spent with Fiona Bruce, or you don't want to hear about the hour I spent with Fiona Bruce?
I think that could be a private hour when you're telling me about that. I'm not sure how our listeners can cope.
She turned up for a recording of A League of Their Own last series with her two teenage kids, and her two teenage kids were bored stiff because it turned out she dragged them along because she liked the show so much. So Fiona and I ended up having a long chat about the history of art. So she is lovely. Next time I see her, I'll send her your regards. I might change the name, though, obviously. It's Thursday, Kieran, so that's news day. And the reason you were plastered all over the telly on Monday is the big news, of course, this week, that Manchester City have successfully overturned their two-year ban from European club competitions. Firstly, Kieran, what's that worth to them financially?
Potentially anything up to a quarter of £1 billion over the course of the next 2 years. Being in the Champions League is incredibly lucrative. It's not just the TV deal, and the TV deal for English clubs is the most lucrative for any of the European countries, because BT themselves put so much in. And the way that it works is the more your domestic broadcaster puts into the pot, the more your football clubs take out. So there's that, there's sponsor bonuses, and of course there's the potential to get to the final of the competition. And from then you can potentially also kick on to the World Club Championship organised by FIFA. So it's very lucrative, and City are absolutely delighted. I've got lots of mates who support City, and I know one or two people there as well, and they were confident. I think we'd said that previously, but this is an amazing verdict as far as they're concerned.
I was speaking to a friend of mine this afternoon who is a sports lawyer. I won't give you his name or his chambers, but I believe they were mentioned in the Times article tomorrow. He basically said that no one in the world of sports law thought that UEFA were going to win this, because of their own idiocy, essentially. They've lost on their own loopholes, essentially, haven't they? Basically, it was a timed out case, UEFA brought the time limits in, and it was beyond their own time limits, and their own process was deemed unlawful. Some of the evidence was gathered illegally, for example. So it with hindsight, even reading the basic CES ruling, it seems like UEFA were in a hiding to nothing from the start, doesn't it?
Yes, I mean, I think the original verdict took people by surprise, and there was an awful lot of parties who were egging UEFA on. We've seen, I think is it eight teams from the Premier League were encouraging them to go ahead with this.
Of course.
And they seemed very pleased with the verdict. Clearly, there were clubs in Spain as well. And we've seen the head of La Liga, Tebas. He's now calling into question the abilities of CAS, which is the top sports court in the world. And it is, you know, renowned for being very procedural, very precise, and very impartial as well. So for him to call into question its own ethics is a sign of the desperation that some of City's critics have shown since the verdict, that there's a lot of very hacked off opponents of the club at present.
There's no way, for example, some of those Spanish clubs will say if Man United end up fifth and argue that they had due cause to believe that would be enough to get in the Champions League, would they have any cause to launch some sort of appeal, or is that it now?
No. I mean, the rules are very clear. It is the top four teams that qualify for the competition. So if City hadn't been, the reason why fifth came into play was that at the time, City were deemed to be not able to qualify for next year's competition. So Manchester United, they've got a very good chance of finishing fourth. And I think their match away to Leicester on the final day of the season will be one, I think, which will provide a lot of interest for TV viewers, those that aren't tuning into Burnley versus Brighton, of course. I think United will also be looking at the other route, which is to win the Europa Cup, which of course they and Wolverhampton Wanderers both have a chance of winning this season.
And of course, UEFA are saying basically that Man City haven't been exonerated here. All that's happened is the process was deemed unlawful. The fine hasn't been completely taken away. It's only been reduced by CAS. So is your instinct that UEFA will appeal now, or is this is as far as it's gone and Man City will be in the Champions League? Because I believe even if UEFA do find a way to appeal, there's no way that's going to happen before the Champions League starts, is it?
That's correct. I mean, UEFA's only avenue that they can go down is to apply to a Swiss federal court. Now, historically, that's not proven to be very successful for people that have had cases lost at CAS. I appreciate they're under a lot of pressure from the European elite. It would be expensive. It would be time consuming. I'm sure that Manchester City would also set up for an injunction if that was the case, which would either prevent the Champions League taking place in 2021 or say that City are allowed to compete in it until the Swiss Federal Court case takes place itself. And it's likely that given it's taken the best part of 6 months for CAS to hold this particular ruling, there's no reason why a Swiss federal court in the middle of a pandemic is going to hurry along to have an appeal from UEFA. So it is a problem. I think it also calls into question the future of FFP. You know, what is it there for? Is it there to reduce debt? Is it there to preserve the existing top table? And it has worked. Yeah, people are saying it's a disaster. FFP has worked to a degree to date because it has effectively put a cap on the amount of spending by those clubs that are funded by sovereign wealth funds. But that cap just happens to be now on a level playing field with the likes of Barcelona and Bayern and Manchester United and so on. And that's what they resent.
Yeah, see, we've obviously been married too long, as I'm just crossing out my next question, which is where does this leave FFP? But also, in a way, where does it leave UEFA? Because it leaves them wounded in the water, doesn't it? And also, it just strikes me now that in the future, every time UEFA hand out a ruling against a club, that club's just going to automatically appeal and on procedural basis. It just seems as though their authority has been undermined by their decision to take a case against their own rules, which turn out to be not fit for purpose.
But very much so. We saw UEFA attempt to prosecute PSG in June 2018, and that was thrown out again through procedural issues. So perhaps UEFA needs to look at its own constitution, to look at its rules, and in terms of FFP, it's either got to scrap them or amend them, or maintain them and just pretend. And I think there'll be a bit of a, it's a bit like a somebody with no clothes on walking through town, just pretend that everything's normal. And it will be a bit of a struggle for them.
Well, it depends who it is who's walking through town with no... I mean, if it's Fiona Bruce, Kieran, obviously you're not going to pretend that's normal. Here's a story, Kieran, I think even UEFA will try and keep out of because it's going to be way too complicated for them. Hearts and Partick Thistle have now been charged by the Scottish FA for taking legal action to try and reverse their relegation. This is getting messy, Kieran, isn't it?
Yes, yes. And I think we suggested that a few weeks ago. Initially, Hearts and Partick were unhappy because they had been relegated, because the Scottish leagues had voted to have tables based on effectively a points per game basis. And that meant that those clubs were going to go down a division. They then applied to the courts. And the court said, well, hold on, you're part of a members club. So therefore, according to your own constitution, you should, if you have any disputes, you should go through the Scottish Football Association, which, remember, is distinct from the Scottish Professional Football League. When we had Neil Doncaster on the show, he's head of the SPFL many moons ago. So therefore, the court actually bounced it over to the SFA, and it looks like the first thing the SFA have done is says, well, you didn't abide by the rules, so therefore we're going to charge you for going to the courts and not coming to talk to us in the first place. Hearts and Partick are now in full of indignation, and this one is going to run and run over the course of the remainder of the summer. I suspect until and potentially beyond when the matches kick off at the start of August, assuming that they do.
Yeah, I'll be honest with you, Kieran. I tried to hold on to that bucking bronco. I fell off about halfway through that, but I think we'll just agree that for the moment it's messy and it's going to get messier. But congratulations, Kieran, are in order to Wycombe Wanderers for reaching the second tier of English football, I believe for the first time ever. It'll be good to see Adi Akinfenwa in the Championship. I'm always a fan of a player who's so big he's got his own postcode. How much could Wycombe gain financially from this, Kieran?
The first thing to say is that they'll now be party to the EFL's TV deal for the Championship, and that's far more lucrative than League One. So that's going to increase their income from about £1 million or just over £1 million to around about £7 million. So that's going to mean that they're going to have record income coming in next year, regardless of whether matches take place in front of a crowd or not, I suspect. In terms of attendances, Wycombe have been averaging around about 5,500 in League One. Adams Park has got a capacity of 10,000. I can imagine that for every away game, it's likely to be sold out if, you know, this is, of course, a huge if, we can return to some form of playing football in front of a paying audience. So the away end, 1,800, there'd be a real scramble for tickets, because I imagine for fans of many clubs in the Championship, they won't have been to Adams Park before. Yeah. So therefore, it's a new one to tick off. And it is a really sort of heartwarming story. You know, Gareth Ainsworth is a really likable manager. He's also been with the club now for a few years. There was a genuine danger of the club going into administration a few months ago. It was owned at the time by the Supporters Trust. It's now owned by an American lawyer called Frank Koenig. And he's managed to put the money in to keep it going over the course of the pandemic. And I think a lot of people are just delighted that a new club's going to be in the Championship. You know, my one fear is that it's a huge step up. You know, Wycombe's wage bill probably in the region of perhaps £4 million. The average wage bill in the Championship is 31. So it's a big gap. And you've only got to look to see what's happened when clubs such as Yeovil have gone up to the Championship. Like they found it really tough. And then, of course, they've tumbled back through the division since then. And I wouldn't wish that upon anyone.
I always remember back in the day when, you know, in the old days, Kieran, if your team was away from home, you went to see a local non-league team. They were in my case, Tooting and Mitcham, normally Carl Shorten. And if Wycombe Wanderers turned up when they were a non-league team, they would have about 1,500, 2,000 away. Their away support was huge, considering the size of their home support. My only fear for Wycombe, and I think they will struggle in the Championship, and I think their fans will probably accept that, my fear is that they will be on television a lot more often now, and I don't think my dad's going to cope well with Gareth Ainsworth's hair, to be perfectly honest. My dad's of a generation where he's not going to want a manager. Look, he really will be saying, "Who's that bloke with the long hair?" And I'll say, "He's the manager, Dad. He's not going to be happy." It's like when he found out Exeter City have got a poet in residence. There was a lot of head shaking when that was going on. Kieran, talking about crowds coming back, the Premier League has a tentative start date of the 12th of September. And they seem unanimously to be requesting or aiming for 40% capacity crowds when that season starts, or in the case of older grounds like Sellers Park and Everton, possibly less. I mean, this is a good step forward, and if it could be carried on through the rest of the leagues, it'd be a great step forward. I imagine the broadcasters would be very happy as well. Is it practical, do you think, from a purely financial point of view? It's not really our remit to go into the how they do it, you know, in terms of whether people sit diagonally or whether the turnstiles are replaced by big gates. But from a financial point of view, is this to be wished for?
Yes, I think on balance, clubs will make a bit more money from this. Clearly, if there is going to be some form of social distancing, yeah, what are you going to do? Will families be allowed to group together and so on? So my understanding is that there's presently a working party, which involves some MPs and some football executives as well. And they are looking at the most practical ways of putting this together so that fans can return. What are you going to do, however, about pinch points? It looks like those clubs who are very reliant upon public transport to get fans to grounds, they might have to go and have a lower percentage of people attending. Then there's the course of the issues of concourses and catering. Will you be able to use the toilets at a football ground? But I was thinking when we were researching this story, I've been going to football for 50 years. I've never done a poo when attending a match. So, you know, do we need the toilets as much as we do?
Well, I mean, as high on the list of questions I wasn't expecting to be asked myself this afternoon, Kieran. I mean, and well done for timing your motion so carefully that you don't need to use I don't think many people use a football toilet for that. I mean, there's certainly some clubs in South East London. I don't think the toilet's ever been used for that purpose, to be perfectly honest, Kieran. And I'm going to have to rack my brain that I don't really want. If this is the first edition of this podcast some people have heard, Kieran, if some master student in football finance accountancy in America is tuning in for the first time, and basically the first question he hears was, have you ever used a toilet for a poo? It's not a good advert for our podcast, Kieran, really. But you make a good point. I presume as well, I mean, away fans for a start will be taken out of the equation completely, won't they? I don't think there'd be any away travel. Turnstiles presumably would be off. You won't be squeezing people through turnstiles. I presume electronic ticketing as well. So that'll act as a kind of track or two. I mean, my big issue is even a club like Palace have got 18,000 season ticket holders. If you're saying that probably for the most of the season, only 6,000 of them can go to each game, what do you do? Do you issue a season ticket so you can go one every three games? Does everybody apply? Do the people who have held their season tickets longer than anybody else, that first 6,000, do they get first go? I mean, there are a lot of practical considerations, but I'm just actually genuinely excited about the idea that we could be getting people back into football grounds. And I think it's more important at League One, League Two level, Kieran. And when you consider most clubs at that level probably have got a capacity of 8,000 and a regular crowd of 3,000, and there's still terraces at that level, you think that would make it easier for fans to social distance in those circumstances, wouldn't you, rather than more difficult?
Yes, I think the Premier League is an amazing vehicle in the sense that over 98% of tickets are sold. So clearly that issue you've raised, especially for those clubs, like Palace, like Brighton, who've got a very high season ticket base as a proportion of total tickets, that is going to be a problem. It could be that clubs will initially write to fans and say, look, given that we are in the middle of the pandemic, what do you want to do? Because if you are of a certain age, if you are in a pensioner's age, you might decide that you don't want to take the risk because you are there's a higher risk of contracting the disease. So I think initially clubs will contact people, then it could go into a ballot. And as you say, it could be one game in three. But I mean, I'm like you. I'm just desperate to go and stand and scream and shout and abuse referees and do the normal things, which isn't the same watching it on television, especially in front of an empty stand. So it's a hopeful welcome step.
If I could just get to the Pawson's Arms and then walk to Sellers Park and watch it on a screen outside, I would take that now. And also, do you know what's really worrying me about that conversation about what you use toilets for? Is that we get a lot of tweets after each episode, Kieran, and now 90% of the tweets we get tomorrow will be from people telling us when they last had a poo in a toilet at a football ground. And it's just you and I doing this. Guy is busy, so for once it's you and I doing it. We won't edit it. It will go straight up. And suddenly Guy's going to wake up tomorrow morning and go, why are people tweeting me about when the last time they had a poo at the Emirates? So you and I, we need to have a chat about the tone of this pod, Kieran, don't we, really?
I'm letting the team down, aren't I? That's what you're trying to say to me, Kevin.
I'm not saying that, Kieran. I'm just saying that some things, we have these conversations. But one day we'll do a pod that includes the things we say to each other for the 10 minutes before and afterwards. But that day's not ready yet, Kieran. And I'm suggesting that maybe that motions. I'm trying to find euphemisms now because I know young people listen to this. It was only the last pod, Kieran, when a young accountancy student described you as a god in his world, and now his god has got feet of clay. Arsenal have announced. Arsenal, as my mother would have said, do you kiss the Baroness with that mouth? Arsenal have announced that you do. I know the answer to that as well, so I don't even know why I asked that question. Arsenal, for the third time, have announced that their owner, Stan Kroenke, has lent some serious cash, serious money to the club. Why is that, Kieran?
It looks as if it's effectively the same as remortgaging, but the benefits for Arsenal is that they currently owe around about £209 million to banks and to bondholders, and they're paying quite a bit of interest on that. So Arsenal have the third highest interest cost of clubs in the Premier League. Spurs have the highest. But Spurs have just had the benefit of this new 62,000-seater stadium, so you can understand that. Manchester United are second because, as we know, the Glazers like paying interest to banks. But for Arsenal, it's £11 million a year. And Arsenal are, I wouldn't say they're struggling financially, but they're trying to find their feet in a football world where they're not qualifying for the Champions League anymore. Mm. And indeed, it looks like they potentially aren't going to qualify for the Europa League as well. So what's happened is that the Arsenal owner, silent Stan Kroenke, who Arsenal fans are a bit peeved with over the years, he's not put money into the club. He's effectively paid off the existing loans, and he's going to lend money to the club itself. Ideally interest-free, but it could be at least at a lower interest. They're currently paying at 6-7%, so you'd hope he wouldn't try to stiff them on the interest rate. That they are looking, according to our friend Swiss Ramble, who we keep asking and keeps refusing to come on the show.
I'm not surprised with your potty mouth, to be perfectly honest.
So he's forecasting a 90 million decrease in revenues for Arsenal in 2021. So an £11 million interest saving will go some way to help that. Players have agreed to pay cuts, but that's only around about 12.5%. So Arsenal are going to face a bit of a black hole financially next year, like many other clubs. So this is one way of going towards that. And for once, I think Kroenke has done the right thing.
Kieran, correct me if I'm wrong, because you know how it works. I'm big picture, your details. That rate of interest, 6-7%, when we spoke about Spurs recently, they're only paying 1-2%. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, Spurs have taken advantage of the government loan scheme, so they've borrowed at 0.5% on that. And as far as the costs of funding the stadium, they've borrowed at 2.5%. So Arsenal are paying far higher rates, and that's sort of a legacy from when they initially borrowed the money, which was a good few years ago when interest rates were higher. So this is one way of addressing that particular issue. And there was another one that under the terms of Arsenal's existing loans, they had to put aside around about £37 million in cash, effectively as a sort of surety, as a guarantee to the lenders that Arsenal would be in a position to repay them. If Kroenke takes over those loans, then in theory, that £37 million could be put into the pot for Arteta to spend or to offer good players new contracts.
So, Kieran, this is a question I think that will interest Tottenham fans as well as Arsenal fans. Arsenal are still paying for the stadium, are they?
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Yes, yeah, they've still got outstanding loans. I mean, they have been repaying them at around about £10 million a year in terms of the capital, but there are still, you know, small amounts of finance. It's £209 million in total. Going back to the legacy of the move. Some of those loans are in relation to other bits and pieces, though, as well.
Okay, well, Kieran, speaking of serious cash, this is a very interesting one. It's only happened today, this morning. And it's a subject we've talked about, Middle Eastern broadcasting rights for the Premier League. Saudi Arabia today have barred beIN Sport, which is the Premier League's official Middle East broadcasters, from operating in Saudi Arabia, which means that if the Saudis were to take over Newcastle, Saudi fans wouldn't be able to watch Newcastle in Saudi Arabia, technically. Is this an indication, do you think, that the Newcastle deal might be off? Because it would seem strange that that the Saudi Arabian authorities have chosen this moment to pick this particular fight. And I know it's a war that's been going on for some time, but this battle is up in the ante, isn't it?
But very much so. I think you're exactly right, Kevin, in saying that have the Saudis, that they're either trying to put pressure on the Premier League to say yes, and then potentially they might reverse that decision in respect of beIN, or they've been given a heads up that they are going to be turned down, that they have failed the owners and directors test, of which there's a lot of political pressure coming from people from Qatar and others. In order to make that decision much quicker. It has been rattling around now for months. So given that the test itself is relatively straightforward, A, do you have any convictions which are unspent? Or B, do you have the resources or not have the resources to take over the club? Then, you know, that shouldn't be taking a huge amount of time. So it could be saber rattling from the Saudi authorities, or it could be that they're sort of throwing their toys out of the pram with regards to this. The beIN Middle Eastern rights, they last until 2022. beIN have paid £400 million for them. And at the moment, what we're seeing is sort of a proxy war between Saudi and Qatar taking place via Newcastle. Certainly, when I've spoken to some of my own Saudi students, who I teach on football finance stuff, they are desperate for the deal to go ahead, and they say that there's huge pent up interest, and Saudi Arabian citizens would effectively then become Newcastle fans because it would be seen as being sort of a quasi club of the Saudi state itself. So it's intriguing, and it's all to do with politics, this, as we've sadly had to say on too many occasions, and nothing to do with football.
Yeah, it would be fairly typical of the Premier League if they were to decide that the richest country in the world are not fit and proper persons to run a football club. But still in the northeast, and then also in the southeast, or the south, if you prefer, Sunderland and Portsmouth both now officially opposed to the Football League salary cap idea, aren't they?
That's right. So this salary cap, and we're only hearing whispers about it. You know, nothing's been confirmed. There's been no pronouncements from the EFL. But the words which have been leaked, and certainly my experience has been that there's many leaky chairmen in the EFL who do tend to have a quick word with either the local paper or the national. So the proposals of League One, the cap would be £2.5 million. Now, at present, the median in League One is 5.6. Sunderland's League One wage bill last season was 27 million. So it would mean a 90% cut for Sunderland. In League Two, it's a 1.5 million proposed cap. So the likes of Sunderland and Pompey, and I also understand Ipswich are here as well. They're saying, well, you know, if we had a cap of 2.5 million, if we were Pompey, that'd only be 28% of our income. You know, we can afford to pay more. What are the benefits of having such a cap? And then you've got the issue of clubs that are being relegated from the Championship. The average wage bill in the Championship is $34 million. To go from 34 to 2.5 between May and August, I think that would be a huge challenge, if not impossibility. And we've had this discussion before. You know, I appreciate you at one point in time, you were involved in HR back in the dim and distant past. Employment contracts simply wouldn't work under those circumstances.
Yeah, we have been married too long, because I was going to mention my dim and distant HR past, because in my dim and distant HR past, I knew the difference between median, mean, and average, and I still get confused. Median is the one in the middle, isn't it?
That's right. It's the one. So if you've got 24 clubs in the Premier League, in League One, it's between 12th and 13th, in effect.
Okay.
What is 12th?
And what's mean, apart from the way you treat the Baroness? Hey!
Hey,
that's the whole reason.
I'm looking after the Baroness very well.
It's the whole reason I started that conversation. And of course, yeah, leaky chairman will of course be the ones needing the toilet. Yeah, so which is the mean compared to the median?
The mean is the average. So you take the total wage bill, divide it by 24. So the mean is 7.4, I think, and the median is 5.6.
So if the mean's the average, what's the average?
The average is the mean. Mean and average are the same.
Are they?
Yeah.
Oh, well, you learned something new every pod, didn't you? There will be people on five continents shaking their heads now going, oh, my God, why is this man hosting a football finance pod? It looks like, Kieran, good news for Chesterfield fans, but there are some loans involved from local and county councils.
That's right. Chesterfield are presently owned by a guy called Dave Allen. And as you and I are both of Irish heritage, yeah, that name has great memories for us.
I wrote for him.
One of the greatest comedians of all time, as far as I'm concerned.
I'll say it again, Kieran. I wrote for him.
Did you?
I did, yeah.
Oh, my word.
Yeah,
you've met Fiona Bruce,
yeah.
And you've written for Dave Allen.
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't a lot.
I'm not worthy.
Yeah, sometimes, yeah. There wasn't a lot of writing. He was mainly making tea and agreeing how brilliant he was, but it was a wonderful year in my life, I have to say. Carry on, Dave Allen, not the...
That is just amazing. The community trust, effectively the supporters group, have been in negotiations with Mr. Allen for a long period of time. And then COVID came along, which sort of, you know, put a fly in the ointment there. But the good news is that both Chesterfield Borough Council and Derby County Council have both agreed to lend the Supporters Trust £500,000 each at a lower rate of interest over a 15-year repayment term. So it looks as if now Chesterfield can sort of go from the bottom up. Yeah, and we are, of course, in favour of fan-owned clubs.
Always, yeah.
And start to build better links with the local community with regards to sort of, you know, making it more in line with the values of the fan base. And, you know, also from a Chesterfield point of view, hoping to get back into the EFL in due course.
Yeah, do you know what? I can never hear the word Chesterfield without getting angry at David Ellery for denying them that goal in the quarterfinal of the FA Cup against Middlesbrough, or semi-final, where it was Sean Dyche was captain of Chesterfield and they scored a perfectly good goal. But I still spend too much of my life being angry at referee David Ellery, who was a proper public schoolboy ponce, but there you go. We both switched our filters off today, haven't we, essentially. Now, last story, Kieran, before we get on to some shout-outs from some of our lovely listeners. You have been looking at the FIFA World Rankings and you've noticed... Oh, God, I've just realised you've noticed something odd down at the bottom. But it's too late for me to change that. You've noticed something odd at the bottom, Kieran.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a train spotter, as people probably have gathered. So I look at the FIFA rankings quite often, and I just happen to notice that if you take the bottom six clubs, we've got San Marino, the Bahamas, Anguilla, the Turks and Caicos Islands, and the British Virgin Islands. They're all tax havens. You know, so... Ooh. Why is it that the most rubbish football clubs or football teams in world football are all connected to people that help you to look after your money in unusual ways? And we've got the Cayman Islands there as well. And I was doing some digging into the Cayman Islands. Yeah, the Cayman Islands is a pretty small operation, but one of their recent heads of Cayman Islands football, a guy called Jeffrey Webb, he then became the head of CONCACAF, which is the effectively the equivalent of UEFA, except it covers sort of the Caribbean area and South America and so on. Mr. Webb then ended up on a racketeering and wire fraud. I never quite understood what wire fraud means, but a wire fraud charges from the US Justice Department, and he's been banned by FIFA, by their ethics committee. So it's all pretty murky stuff. But getting into FIFA, being a FIFA-ranked country, is very, very lucrative, because what happens is that every year you get a large check to spend on football issues. And I'm certainly aware, because I have had I've been very privileged to sort of teach all around the world. You know, I've looked at some of the local grounds and I've wondered where that money has gone. And there are an awful lot of people, and I'm quite confident in saying this. You know, FIFA is a mafia organization, as far as I'm concerned. And that's why mafia countries such as Russia were awarded the World Cup in 2018. But it does make you feel uncomfortable that there's other countries who have applied to FIFA who haven't got in, who aren't particularly good at football. But all of these countries, which just happen to be tax havens, have slipped through the net and are allowed to play football. But by all accounts, they're a bit bobbins.
Yeah, I'm going to say two things to that, Kieran. The first thing is that back in the day when I was a builder, wire fraud basically involved replacing copper wire with plastic wire and getting the money out of it. But I think this needs to be the subject of a whole pod, Kieran, because I was, you know, Guy tucked this question away at the end where it's normally a little light-hearted question, but at the risk of sounding like Richard Osman on Pointless, these six countries you mentioned are all sovereign states in their own right, et cetera, et cetera. But I think what you've said there is much broader than I was expecting you to say, and I think this is something we need to think about, talk about, and maybe make a subject for our next poll, Kieran, because this is a big, well, I'm going to say accusation, isn't it? I mean, I instinctively edged away from the microphone when you accused FIFA and Russia of being mafia countries. I'm not disagreeing, but I want those people to make sure it's only your voice they heard. I ushered the cat out of the garage as well in case she meowed and got ahead. I'm going to suggest we stop talking about that, Kieran, and we make it a proper investigation for another pod, because it's a very... At the very least, it's an interesting observation that those six countries are, as you say, pretty much tax havens or brass plaques on walls, aren't they? So I think we should leave that one there, Kieran, and we'll come back to that, because it's, I think that's a subject we need to do more justice to, and I hope our listeners understand that at short notice. So well done. You've opened another can of worms. That's about four cans of worms we've got juggling at the moment. That's great. Now, if you would like to support The Price of Football, and I hope you will, you can do so by visiting supporter.acast.com/priceoffootball or just by clicking the link if you're listening to the Acast app. And we'd like to say a big thank you to everyone who has supported us so far, including, and as we're entertainers here, Kieran, this is not just going to be a list of names. It's going to be a list of names with some comments and some wry remarks afterwards. So people who supported us so far include Seth, who says, great podcast on all aspects of football finance, entertaining and informative. Get the Baroness on, which I believe is an instruction you issue at least twice a week.
Not on my age.
Oh, you do cheer me up sometimes, Kieran, you know. Eric Scorzoni is listening from Detroit, Michigan. It could be Eric Scorzoni, but as it's American, I like to think it's Eric Scorzoni. He's out there in Detroit, Michigan. Eric says, thank you for the great show. Enjoyed the book, Kieran. And then, as he knows that I get the hump very easily, he also added, I enjoy Kevin's take on things. So that's nice. He enjoys your book and my take on things. Chris Lowe, who in his own brackets says, unfortunately, not the one from the Pet Shop Boys, which is a shame.
You met the Pet Shop Boys, no doubt, given your long list of showbiz chums.
We've been in the same room. That's as far as I'm willing to go with it. We have been in the same room. But yeah, talking to the Pet Shop Boys, as I always say to you, Kieran, it's a sin. no, really, Kieran, it is. What you just said is a sin. Chris Lowe says, thank you for your podcast. It truly is top drawer. I only wish you could do it every day. And thank you to Kieran for answering my tweet. I did not expect that, he said. That's very nice of you. John, M54, who's been on before, so thank you for your double contribution. And we did the M54 joke last time. So John says, thanks for all the good perspective on the game. Much more valid than the Twitter ranting I read. That's one for the poster, isn't it? Better than Twitter rants. next Edinburgh show I do, I'm going to put, Kevin Day, better than Twitter rants. Wanstead Martin, at Wanstead, far southeast of London. Wanstead Martin, thanks for an excellent show and for showing what a horrible, murky world football finance is. Just doing our job. Mark W says, good to know someone is keeping an eye on the finances, looking out for supporters' interest. And Gavin just says, keep up the good work, chaps. And Gavin, I apologise. I don't know why the fact that somebody called Gavin would call us chaps made me laugh so much. It's a terrible working class chip on the shoulder thing. But thank you for those comments, Gavin. And thank you for everybody else, Seth and Eric and Chris and John and Wanstead Martin and Mark. If you have a question for us, Sunday and Monday are our question as I'll say that again. Guy's not going to edit this, so it doesn't matter. So I'll say it again. Monday is our questions pod, which we just tend to record it on a Sunday evening. If you have a question for us, it's questions@priceoffootball.com. And till then, have a lovely weekend of football. I don't intend watching Crystal Palace play ever again, Kieran, after last Sunday's debacle. It's entirely my fault because I said to my friends Tom and Ash, who won the off licence down the road, that we were going to beat Villa, and I take full responsibility for that awful, awful showing.
I was cheering you on as well. So
unlike
last night at Wigan, where my cardboard cutout made its debut, they didn't take on my willingness from afar to get a result.
That was a score that came somewhat out of the blue, wasn't it? After we spoke about Wigan on Sunday. 8-0.
Yes, well, yeah, clearly perhaps it was an inspirational podcast they listened to before the match, which made them score those 7 goals in 45 minutes.
Yes, and we had Caroline Molyneux on from the Wigan Supporters Club, who doesn't let the grass grow under her feet, because even as we speak, I know she's on a Zoom conversation with some friends of mine who organise charity Zoom quizzes during lockdown. We're going to do one to raise money for the Wigan Athletic crowdfund, hopefully next week. So we'll give you more details on that on Monday. In the meantime, as I say, have a lovely weekend. And Kieran, it's time for your catchphrase, which people miss if you don't say it.
Stay safe, boys and girls. The price of football. Price of football.